A strong low-pressure system will organize in the plains today, and upper-level disturbances ahead of that low will spread scattered showers and thunderstorms east of the Mississippi River today and tonight. A southerly flow ahead of the system will bring much warmer air back into the Midwest for the weekend. The storm system will slowly track east and produce scattered showers and thunderstorms across the area through Sunday night. Locally heavy rain and severe thunderstorms will be possible in parts of the region tomorrow and Sunday. High temperatures today will range from the upper 50s in northeastern Iowa to the low 70s in western Missouri. Lows tonight will range from the upper 40s in southern Wisconsin to the 60s in Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, cloudy and breezy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high 65. The wind from the south at 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 30. Tonight, cloudy and warmer with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. We'll see a low in the low 50s. The wind will be out of the south from 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms are likely. Look for a high of 72. It will be breezy with a wind from the southwest at 20 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy and breezy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The low 62. The wind from the south at 15 to 20 with gusts to 30 miles per hour. Sunday, partly sunny and windy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Expect a high in the upper 70s with the wind out of the south from 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 35 miles per hour. Sunday night, showers and thunderstorms are likely. We'll see a low around 60. The outlook for Monday, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. A little bit cooler Monday. Look for a high in the upper 60s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid-50s to the mid-60s. Most locations in Illinois, cloudy. Sunshine, the rule in Indiana. At Rockford, 60 degrees. At O'Hare, 63. Light rain in Bloomington, 55 degrees there. In Mattoon, 59. 58 at Carbondale. In South Bend and Indianapolis, 62. In Lafayette and Terre Haute, 64. Willard Airport reported a cloudy sky at the top of the hour, 60 degrees. The dew point, 28. The relative humidity, 29%. The wind out of the south at 18. The barometric pressure, 30.18 and falling. And at 1240, 59 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Companies like Apple, Google, and Amazon are trying to get customers to store everything from family photos to favorite films online in what's known as cloud-based storage. The criminal copyright case of the file-sharing site Mega Upload could have implications for all kinds of cloud-based businesses. A hearing in the case today is focusing on what happens when clearly legal files are blocked by authorities along with the allegedly illegal ones. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Kyle Godwin was a customer of Mega Upload, and last January he was having a very bad day. He's building a new business taking videos of local sports teams in Cleveland. He sells highlights to family and friends of the players. He backed all his material up on a hard drive, but then...
right in the middle of a save, I knocked it off my coffee table and it hit the floor. And I can't get any of the files off of that external hard drive, and that was basically everything I've worked on for the last 6 months.
Arg. Then Godwin remembered he had a paid account with Mega Upload where he had most of his files backed up. Godwin went to the site to retrieve his videos.
But all I got was the opening screen, and I couldn't get into any of the files, couldn't get into the file manager. I didn't know what was going on.
What was going on was that the Justice Department had shut down Mega Upload and arrested several of its top executives for criminal copyright infringement. The DOJ claimed that the vast majority of traffic from the site's 66 million customers was illegal.
When I heard about that, I'm like, this doesn't even involve me. So how do I get my files back? I need them now.
Godwin may never get them back. That's what the lawyers are in court about this morning. Mega Upload rented servers from a company called Carpathia Hosting. That's where Godwin's files are. Mega Upload is the only one that can unlock the files of customers like Kyle Godwin, and they have been shut out by the federal government. Carpathia is asking a federal court to tell it what to do with the servers. The Justice Department refused to give an interview, but in court documents, it's asking the judge not to get involved in what it calls a private contractual matter between Carpathia and Mega Upload. The online civil rights group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is filing a brief on behalf of Godwin and other innocent customers. Julie Samuels is an attorney with the EFF, and she says this online case shouldn't be any different than a real-world case, say if a bank were to be seized.
There are innocent third parties who might have items at that bank in a safety deposit box and some other kind of deposit account, and the law and the Constitution, frankly, contemplate a way for those innocent third parties to get their grandmother's pearls back.
Samuel says there's no reason that the digital world should be different from the real one. Except, well, it is. Jim Berger, a copyright attorney, says in this case we are talking about a huge amount of material and the court would probably have to appoint someone to sort through it.
To say, oh yes, this 100 megabytes is Mr. Smith's and it's legal, it's his personal stuff, but this 50 megabytes is clearly infringing. It would take forever to sort humans to sort through 25 petabytes of data.
Yet Berger and Samuels agree that the implications of what happens to the material on the servers are great. Companies like Google, Amazon, and Apple are trying to entice their customers to store more stuff online, from family photos to legally purchased films. If Mega Upload's legitimate customers can't retrieve their files, Berger admits many people will be afraid to use cloud storage.
If I'm in the cloud business, I want this done right.
Ultimately, says Berger, there are no laws directly applicable. It will be up to the judge to determine what is fair. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
This is the Afternoon Magazine from Illinois Public Media. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. Today is the St. Louis Cardinals' home opener against the Chicago Cubs. For reporter Veronique LaCapra, baseball season means it's time to talk about science and America's national pastime. Washington University aerospace engineer David Peters was happy to oblige.
I'm a baseball fan from day one. I was at Stan Musial's last game here in St. Louis. Turns out I was in Cincinnati and happened to go to the game when Pete Rose broke Ty Cobb's record. I was at the game where Roger Maris's home run record was broken by Mark McGwire. I've just been a baseball fan, always have been.
I can imagine there's a lot of physics involved in pitching. Can you talk about some of the main types of pitches, the curveball, like the physics behind them?
Yeah, the basic principle is called the Bernoulli principle. And the Bernoulli principle says that when air speeds up, its pressure goes down. And when air slows down, its pressure goes up. So the top of the ball is spinning towards the batter. The bottom of the ball is spinning away from the batter. So the top spinning towards the batter slows down the air on the top of the ball. And since the air slows down, the pressure goes up. The bottom of the ball, it's spinning away from the batter, actually speeds the air up. So it's high pressure on the top, low pressure on the bottom. It pushes the ball down. Ball falls much faster than just gravity would make it. And they call it a 12 to 6 curveball because it goes from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock on the clock down. You can't believe it. It's like it's unmerciful. And almost every pitch, fastball, curveball, knuckleball, they move because of air pressure. And they move because of Bernoulli's principle and the different ways the pitcher makes them spin.
And so what about the guy who's on the receiving end of those 80-mile-an-hour pitches? How do you even focus on a ball that's coming at you that fast, let alone control where it's going to go or hit it out of the park?
This is one of the incredible coincidences about baseball, or Abner Doubleday knew what he was doing or something. It's 60 feet 6 inches from home plate to the pitcher's mound, although the pitcher's leaning forward, so he's maybe 55 feet away, you know, when the ball comes. Ball going at 90 miles an hour is about 130 feet a second. That takes about a half a second to get to the plate. The human reaction time is a half a second. If the pitcher's mound were 45 feet from home plate, nobody would ever get a hit. Every game would be a no-hitter.
Really?
That's right. So this is the beauty of it, but it's right on the verge. So you have to have very good reflexes. You have to think. You have to have good eyes. A good batter can actually see the stitching on the ball and see it spinning and can tell which way it's spinning, whether it's going to be a curveball.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you at all. Still, it's barely time to make that decision. And it's amazing you can do it. People have said it's the most difficult thing in sports, hitting this little round ball with a round bat and making it go exactly where you want it to, but you can.
So I have to ask, do ball players really think about all this science when they're out on the field, or do they just do it without really understanding it?
For a long time, players just did it. But Ted Williams was probably the greatest hitter of all time. He thought hitting was a science, and he wrote a book on the science of hitting, and he actually analyzed it. And he learned several things in his studies. First, he learned that bat speed was the most important thing. Up until then, people used these huge, heavy bats like clubs. You know, Babe Ruth had a bat that was 42 ounces or something, you know. And you can't argue with Babe Ruth, but Ted Williams decided that weight's important, but speed was better. And so the bats have gotten lighter. And Ted Williams worked out these angles and where you should, like, move your elbow in or move your elbow out, how to get the best angle of the bat on the ball. And he set out his goal to become the best hitter of all time, and he really did. So
science matters even in baseball.
Science matters. Science is everywhere.
Washington University aerospace engineer David Peters. He spoke with Illinois Public Radio's Veronique LaCapra and discussed the science of baseball. Today is the St. Louis Cardinals' home opener against the Chicago Cubs.
Support comes from 40 North 88 West, presenting the 10th Annual Boneyard Arts Festival, April 19th through 22nd. With venues throughout the county, the festival, in conjunction with the local business community, is a celebration of music, dance, arts, culture, and theater. Information on this year's festival is at 40north.org.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 13th of April, 2012. The birthday of Thomas Jefferson, born Albemarle County, Virginia, 1743, primary author of the Declaration of Independence, who also wrote books on farming and gardening, and whose personal library was the largest private collection in this country, 6,487 volumes. He sold it to Congress after the British burned down the Library of Congress. It's the birthday of Samuel Beckett, born in Fox Rock, a suburb of Dublin, 1906. Studied French literature in college, then went to Paris, where he met James Joyce, who by that time was almost blind and working on Finnegan's Wake. Beckett became his assistant. He read books to Joyce. He took dictation. He walked with him around Paris. He idolized Joyce so much that he began to smoke like Joyce and walk like Joyce. And he tried to write in Joyce's meandering style, but Beckett said, "I realized that my own way was in taking away, in subtracting, rather than in adding." 1952, Samuel Beckett wrote his play Waiting for Godot, with its repeated motif, "I can't go on, I will go on," in which Estragon says, "I can't go on like this," and Vladimir says, "That's what you think." Samuel Beckett, who wrote, "My mistakes are my life. Where I am, I don't know. I'll never know. In the silence, you don't know. You must go on. Try again, fail better." He wrote, "We are all born mad. Some remain so. Dance first, think later. It's the natural order." And Samuel Beckett said, "Nothing is funnier than unhappiness." And it's the birthday of Eudora Welty, born Jackson, Mississippi, 1909, who wrote several novels, including The Optimist's Daughter, but she's best known for her short stories, which she wrote and rewrote, cutting them apart at her dining room table. You can tour her house and garden in Jackson for $5, the house at 1119 Pinehurst Street. She moved into the house in 1925 with her parents when she was 16, and she lived there until she died in 2001. The garden has been restored, too. It was planted by her mother, Chestina, so that there would be something in bloom all year round. Larkspur, hollyhocks, and snapdragons in the spring, phlox, zinnias, and blue salvia in the summer, asters, chrysanthemums, and spider lilies in the fall, and camellias and pansies in the winter, and climbing roses on trellises. Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran, entitled Storage. That year we left the house we couldn't afford and put our belongings in storage. We were free now to travel or live in tiny spaces. We kept our chairs and tables in a cement cell, our bookshelves, our daughter's old toys, clothes we wouldn't wear or discard. There were books we liked but did not need, and mattresses and pots and pans. Sometimes we went to visit our things, sat in our rocking chairs, searched for a jacket, listened to an old radio. It was like visiting someone I loved in a hospital, the way, removed from the world, a person or object becomes thin, diminished. The furniture on which we lived our young life had no job but to wait for us. It remembered our dinners,